Dr. Americus Reed is a brand identity theorist, a professor of marketing at the Wharton Business School, and has made the rounds like all of us talking heads do, CNN, CNBC, Forbes, you know how that goes. He also hosts his own podcast on the SiriusXM Business Channel. Please welcome Dr. Americus Reed to the show. Hello.
Hi, guys. It's really a great pleasure to be here with you, Cooper and Anthony. Super excited.
Thank you. Well, we are too.
Yeah, we needed you here because we were having conversations the other day that we realized we're completely out of our depths, that we were talking about all the Super Bowl brands, Ford and Budweiser and Coca-Cola, who decided not to run Super Bowl ads. And we were speculating on it. And I was like, well, let's get an expert in here, somebody who actually knows what's going on.
Yes.
So hence you, Dr. Reed. You know, I never use doctor. Do you use doctor?
You know, I don't use doctor. I usually just ask my students to call me Americus because I don't want to feel dated. You know, I don't want to feel like I'm old. So
right. Yeah. So. I know. And it's like I have a PhD. How many PhDs do you even have? More than one?
I just have one. And,
But
the one degree that I have up in my office is the one from kindergarten, because that's the one that counts. You know, I don't know where my PhD degree is. I think my mother has that maybe.
That's good. That's mine is. So my dog got a big award a couple of years ago for being a therapist. Animal. Ooh. So his award from the AKC is like up, and then my PhD is like right below it.
That's awesome.
Which is how we did it. Yep. So all right. So Super Bowl. Let's talk about the Super Bowl. So this is Super Bowl LV, which I think is 55.
55.
Yes. Okay. That's good. If I'm remembering properly. Yep. So you know, an ad for this year's Super Bowl costs $5.5 million for just a 30-second spot.
Yes.
And there are all these iconic Super Bowl brands, like we mentioned, Coke and Budweiser. Mm-hmm. They're not going to be advertising.
That's correct.
So now I've read that it's because they're worried about the optics of it. Mm-hmm. You know, spending that much money when the country is facing a pandemic and racial unrest, social unrest, political unrest. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's 100% correct, Cooper. I mean, I don't know what you guys think, but it to me, it almost feels like somewhere in between, you know, trying to reach out and make make some kind of statement about the importance of the moment, but also part virtue signaling as well. You know, sort of like, well, we can make a lot of money in different ways and get our message out there in different ways. So we're going to like really look like we're, you know, taking time to pause in this moment and not do the normal thing. And the action of not doing the normal thing is in of itself kind of signaling to the marketplace in some ways, right? So I think there's some decision calculus that's going on there that's saying, listen, you know, we want to be a little bit sensitive to the moment because, you know, we just had kind of almost an insurrection in the Capitol and the democracy almost got toppled. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if we're out there, you know, hawking Mountain Dew or hawking Pepsi or hawking Coke or whatever, you know, it may not, like you said, Cooper, it may not really have the type of optics that we want to have right now. And plus, you know, they have a million different other ways that they can go and talk to consumers and stay in line with consumers and things like that.
Yeah. I think by not doing it, sorry, Anthony, but I just want to make the point that by not doing it, aren't they doing it in a way? Like by coming out and saying like, we're not going to participate, people are going to be like, wow, I really respect Coke. I'm going to use that product a little more now.
Exactly. And I think the other interesting aspect about this is that, you know, brands that advertise in the Super Bowl were already moving toward what we refer to as kind of an omni-channel kind of messaging strategy, where you show a little bit of something on the Super Bowl to get a bunch of eyeballs, because that's sort of a big awareness play. But then you have all these other things going on your social media channels, whether it be TikTok and other kinds of things. So lots of places to play. And so the absence of a message on the big stage actually might amplify the effectiveness and the salience of the messages on these other stages.
Right. So sneaky.
But isn't it going to hurt them in the long run? Because getting on the Super Bowl opens them up to a huge impression that they're not going to get on TikTok. They're not going to get anywhere else. They're missing the 100 million plus impressions.
Yeah, that's a great question, Anthony. I think under a normal year, that would be correct. So in other words, a lot of these brands, whether it be Coke or Budweiser, would normally be there because there's an expectation that they're there. Mm-hmm. And not being there would be signaling that maybe something's wrong with the company. Mm-hmm. But I think because we're in a moment now where there's just so much division and unrest and chaos and the pandemic and the things going on with the economy and a new administration coming in, that this is a different kind of moment, because in this sort of space, it's like I can still pull back And because, you know, Anthony and Cooper and Americus are talking about it, I'm still going to get some oxygen, you know, and some play on this. But I get to also get a little bit of this credit for being such a morally good company. So it's kind of interesting.
Now, when it comes to brands, like, okay, so we've talked about, you and I've talked before, because I've had you on every incarnation of radio show I've had so far in the past year. So when it comes to the big brands, I think I have a good understanding, and I know there's a lot of research, and I read your study, so I know there's even more to it than I even realized. But what about personal brands? Like, what about, okay, so like our listeners right now, they're listening, like, they're like, I don't really care about Ford and Budweiser. Mm-hmm. How do I improve my own brand? And how do I even know what my brand is? So I'm sure you get asked that question all the time, but you know, our listeners haven't had a chance to ask you that. So I'm asking on their behalf.
I appreciate the question, Cooper. I think, you know, this is huge right now. Let me just preface all of this by saying that, and I tell my students this all the time, Anthony and Cooper, because it's like everything you do out there, everything that you put out there is part of the brand building process. So the question is not whether or not you're, you know, going to build a brand. You are going to build a brand every time you open your mouth. The only question is, are you going to try to regulate what that brand is and try to create that brand proactively and strategically? So what I always tell students is, first of all, be very careful on that stuff that you're doing, you know, if it, you know, wild night out or whatever, because that stuff stays on Twitter, it stays on Instagram, it stays on these platforms forever. And employers are actually checking that stuff, by the way. But what I always tell students is to say, you know, think through kind of the process of what is my gift to the world? And what is my passion that I do that no one else does? And to think about kind of articulating that in every aspect of what you say about yourself and the things that you do and the footprint that you create out there in terms of social media. And if you're not doing that, you know, then it's kind of like you're just out there with a brand that's organically happening without your knowledge. And so you don't want to end up in that situation where you're not in control of your brand. I think about sort of the classic, you know, I am a Mac versus I'm a PC commercials where Apple came out and branded Microsoft. Right. And Microsoft sat there and sort of allowed themselves to be. They took it. They allowed that image to happen. So don't do that. Be in charge of your own personal brand. Get out there. I mean, we have the tools now. All of us have the tools, the social media tools, the blogging tools, all of these things to actually go out there and actually create the type of brand that we need to create.
Now, for companies, do you see going 5-10 years down the road? Are companies buying more into ratings of TV, radio, or are they buying more in an impression world now?
I think it's what companies are really doing, Anthony, right now is trying to buy conversations. So what I'm noticing now is it's less about impressions per se, to the extent that an impression can lead to a consumer talking about what you're doing. So now the really smart companies are really trying to tap into the power of word of mouth and to get consumers organically having these conversations. And that's actually tying back to what we were talking about earlier, that's actually one of the big plus benefits of the Super Bowl is that the Monday after, everyone's kind of talking about these commercials and it gets all this additional oxygen. But what companies are really doing, Anthony, is they're trying to facilitate a reason for their story to be shared. And so that's kind of where what I'm seeing in terms of, you know, the business world and the branding world is where things are really going right now is, can I get consumers to talk? Because word of mouth is really the most powerful market driver that exists out there. You know, we can say a million things in an ad, but if, you know, Cooper is like, she's the person I know that loves her dogs. So if she tells me, go buy this type of pet food, I'm buying it. And that's the end of it. You know, it doesn't matter. So it's that kind of, you're trying to get people to have these conversations. And to the extent that impressions can lead to a conversation to trigger something in your mind, then you're doing something that's pretty smart as a company.
What about cursing? Like I've noticed, I feel like, you know, I look on social media and there are certain jokes that are just funnier and things that are just funnier if someone throws a curse word in. Like when someone says like frickin', I can't really relate to somebody that uses the word frickin', but once in a while, like I have to use the word frickin' because I'm, you know, talking about a brand or something and I don't think they want me cursing. So what if you say the employer, they go back and they look and they see like, where you're drinking and how much were you drinking and did you have a joint in your hand?
Yeah.
But do they also look to see how often you use the F word.
Love that. First of all, can I curse on this show? I'm
yes.
Of course.
We bleep it out, but you can do
Holy
it.
Holy shit. Okay, great. I just that was bubbling up inside of me, so I just had to get that out. I think all of it's context, because employers are really look. So see, this is where it goes back to what you guys were saying about building the personal brand. If my personal brand is kind of this edgy kind of thing, like I'll give you an example. There's a guy out there named Gary V. And every third word, he's kind of like a motivational speaker, entrepreneur guy. Every third word is the F-bomb. Mm. And that's just part of the brand, you know? So if it's like part of like your identity, if it's part of this organic kind of thing that you create naturally, then it makes sense, right? But if it's out of some kind of context and not part of that brand building process, it's probably going to hurt you, actually.
Right. Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah, because it's a regional thing, too, because people in the South take it a little bit different than people in New York.
Totally. Like in New York, I might say F you and then and get a handshake, you know?
Yeah. In the South, you can't do that. You know,
No.
They don't even know what that word is. And they look at you like you got 6 feet.
That's right.
Cooper.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Okay. I was waiting for you to finish your thought. So let's talk about cancel culture, because
cancel culture. Oh my God. Yes.
I'm sure that is another topic that you cover on a regular basis.
I mean,
there's a lot of it. And there's just so many aspects to it to even go into. Yeah. So what's your go-to conversation when somebody asks you about cancel culture before I even get to my specific questions?
Yeah. No,
what's your philosophy on cancel culture?
Here's my philosophy on cancel culture. First of all, I have to oftentimes educate people to know the difference between cancel culture and capitalism. Those are not the same. Are not the same things. So sometimes you enter into an agreement with a company, say, for example, to publish a book or to sell a product on their website or something like that. And there's an implicit agreement that says you're a brand. Going back to the personal brand question, Cooper.
Right.
You're a personal brand, and I'm co-branding with you to have this 1+1=3 synergy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a desirable business transaction because of that. Now, if you go off and do something crazy, like, praise an insurrection, right, then I might say to myself, guess what? I don't really want to publish your book anymore. And that's my own personal business, because as a private company, I don't really want to risk my brand being associated with that imagery. So in that case, it's like, see, you're out the door, but it's not personal. It's just like the business transaction is no longer desirable for me. That's not cancel culture. That's just capitalism. Okay.
Got it.
Okay. So cancel culture is basically where you're saying that the slightest difference of disagreement in a particular position, the slightest language is not tolerated. It's kind of this idea that, you know, it's this notion that you need the safe space. You just can't hear something that is in disagreement with what you are believing. And so you push that out of your echo chamber and you basically just say, I'm not going to listen to anything that's, you know, related to that whatsoever. That's what cancel culture is. But, you know, there seems to be a lot of political figures out there that are getting cancel culture and capitalism confused.
Yeah, that's true. Because they don't have Dr. Americus Reed, or they don't have our buddy Americus to explain to them the difference, because they don't have you don't have a branding person. Like, you don't have a branding. You're somebody in the public eye, and you have a branding person to have this conversation with you on a regular basis.
Exactly.
Like, this is an important conversation.
Exactly.
And it brings me to, you know, it's interesting. The thing about cancel culture that I find fascinating, and as you were talking, I was thinking about how people do go back on old tweets and old, you know, again, same thing, the employer, but people do that. Like, the minute you become famous, the minute you are somehow in the public eye, they start looking back at things you might have said like 10, 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think about that aspect of cancel culture? I mean, do you think that that's unfair? Do you think people have changed? Do you think that it's ridiculous? What's your philosophy on that?
I think it's absolutely fair, Cooper. I think, you know, you sign your name on the dotted line when you sell your soul for stardom, and it says, you know, you're in the fishbowl. So whether you like it or not, I can go back and look at whatever it is that you've said in the past, and I can ask you about it. Mm. Now, to me, the problem becomes when someone brings this stuff up and your answer is to pretend like it never happened.
Like,
the receipts are there, Anthony, and they're like, wait a second, you know, you're going to pretend like you never said those things. To me, be authentic, going back to the personal brand, be real, be who you are, and be, it's okay to admit, you know, I've changed my mind. I have a different point of view than when I was saying X, Y, and Z in previous conversations, et cetera, et cetera. That's perfectly fine. And I think people recognize that. I think where people get into trouble is when there's this kind of, this sort of almost like, I'm going to pretend like
my account was hacked.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's my
exactly.
favorite when my account was hacked.
Or like Ambien. What? I was on
right.
Ambien.
My cousin Bootsy broke into my Twitter and right. Somehow, you know, used the F-bomb. I have no idea what happened there. Mm-hmm. Okay, it says this is popping up all over social media. I don't know if you're following this, but this GameStop stock debacle is super interesting. And I want to get you guys' thoughts on this because a colleague of mine said something today that was really fascinating about this. And he said that these kids on Reddit that are trying to bankrupt the billionaires in the hedge funds are this is what he said I thought was really interesting. Their psychology is no different than the Proud Boys who have been told that there is this evil thing that's out there that rails against them and that cheats in the system. And so we have to go out and actually aggress against them. So it's like there's this grievance psychology that I'm going to take down these powerful people and restore my own kind of identity. And I thought that was really interesting because I'm looking at the chat on Reddit and all of this stuff. And it's like there is a lot of this kind of like, you know, these billionaires that are always cheating and shorting stocks and stuff. And now we're going to stick it to them and kind of like, you know, give them their comeuppance and even the score. There's a lot of similar kind of psychology to this, like grievance kind of thing that we right. see a lot in all of this. And it kind of struck me as quite interesting. What do you guys think about
that? I have two thoughts on this. One is I think we just spent 4 years being really angry at the Trump administration it depends on your perspective. But I think for a lot of people, the perspective was that, you know, Trump and his family came in and they just used our country to feel like how they can line their pockets and how it was all about greed and money and cronyism. Mm. And, you know, even though he kept talking about relatable and the little guy, he really wasn't one of them, you know, right. and he didn't really do anything for them. He didn't do anything that he promised them. There was no new health care. He didn't build the wall. He said he was going to build, like, he didn't do all the things that they wanted. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a lot of years of just anger at rich people, at the establishment. And I think that was reflected in there. Yeah. And then, you know, I think about this about cancel culture also. I look back at like when I was growing up and how angry we used to get and how we would rail against, Tipper Gore and people like that who were trying to like silence our and censor our rap music.
Yeah.
It's like we spent years being like, don't censor us. Like that's our generation. We're speaking from the heart. We're speaking from our, you know, I grew up, I know I don't look it, but I grew up in the hood in Brooklyn and in the island.
Nice.
And I would listen.
So you might cut somebody, Cooper.
Yeah,
huh?
I'll have a razor
in your pocket.
Oh yeah, I'll cut a bitch. You don't know. You know who you're talking to here. But I mean, you know, and like we, you know, that music was really part of.
Yeah.
You know, not obviously I'm white, so I don't relate to it the same way, but I do in the way that I did grow up. Mm-hmm. You know, amongst the kind of people that were making rap music, and the idea of censorship and censoring music, you know, I mean, especially as like a radio girl, like I'm all about free speech, obviously. So it's like we spent years protecting free speech and now everybody wants to cancel it. Now everybody's like, you know, you can't have money. You can't have say your piece, you know, so.
Yeah, no, that's interesting.
I can't really. I can't fit those two thoughts together. And I feel like I don't know if it's generational.
Yeah.
Or what?
Yeah, I think that's a super fascinating comment because it's always a cautionary tale, right? The notion of, like, for example, I was talking to a friend of mine who was telling me one of her friends took her MyPillow and burned it and put it on Twitter. And so the MyPillow guy is the latest, I guess, in the cancel culture. And they kicked him off of Twitter and people are burning the pillows now. But it's interesting because it forces the question to your mind of what happens if someone starts censoring you know, something that I'm interested in, you know, and you have to kind of confront that.
He's encouraging violence. That's right.
I mean, there's a difference. Yeah. There's a big difference. And I think there's a legitimate difference, but it's not that far away from language that you just don't like as opposed to language that could cross some kind of legal line. So it's something that that for me, I want to confront inside my own sort of heart and mind, which is to be able to say, listen, if I'm going to, you know, say that certain types of language or speech shouldn't be said, then I have to be willing to, you know, to have that be something that's equally applied. And so, you know, it's a bit of a challenge to force yourself to think about that kind of reality.
Right. Well, no, that's, it is a challenge.
What I think happened today on Wall Street is the same thing that happened in the 80s with Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy. it was trading places.
It was the Dukes.
It was the Dukes.
And it's the Wall Street has been the Dukes forever. And it's always been, you know, old white guys making money. As soon as somebody new comes in and they start making money, you got to shut it down immediately. And that's what happened was, oh my God, outsiders are figuring this thing out. We have to stop it and stomp it. And I think that's what happened.
Interesting.
Yeah, turn the machines back on like that.
Yeah,
right.
That's exactly.
That's a fantastic movie. But it's filmed in Philadelphia, by the way.
So. Was it really?
It was. It was actually filmed in Trading Places was filmed in Philadelphia. And every time it comes on, it's one of those movies that every time it comes on, wherever I am, I'll stop and watch it.
It's a good one. Yeah, it's a good classic.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Americus. We love talking to you. You're so smart. You're helping us out. We really appreciate you setting us straight with all these questions we've had for like a week now. So thank you.
I certainly appreciate it. Thanks a lot. It's always a blast to come on you guys' show. You guys rock. You're awesome. So it's a pleasure to spend some time with you guys, you know, chopping it up.